Hello, my name is David Runciman, and this is Talking Politics. And we are with you in real time this week. I'm joined by Helen Thompson and Chris Bickerton. Some of us have been away, you may have noticed.
Summer highlights.
Summer?
It has to be swimming in the sea, and the Atlantic Ocean was, I think, around 18 degrees.
The boat trip around the fjords in Oslo was magical.
Getting completely soaked on the rain and marshes.
As always, we're in my office, and there are some rumbly lorries going down the road outside. Please don't be put off. They come and they go. And so we thought we would talk about things that have been on our minds. We haven't gathered around this table for about a month. Stuff's been happening. It always does. British politics has sort of been on holiday. I think Theresa May comes back to work today. American politics has not been on holiday, I don't think. I mean, with Trump, it doesn't really... He's either on holiday all the time or he's never on holiday. There's no... But 2 weeks ago, we had North Korea. That rumbled on for a while. This has been the week of Charlottesville and the white supremacist violence. That story is ongoing. We're not going to focus on Trump today. I'm sure we will in future episodes. But each of us has sort of thought about something that's just been nagging away at us for a while. I'm going to talk in a little bit about Corbyn and Venezuela. But Helen, you want to talk about Congress and Russia. So not Trump and Russia, but Congress, which is still, Trump sucks up all the oxygen, all the airtime, everyone's attention. But American politics is still operating by a set of rules, and Congress is the engine room of American politics. So what is the thing that you think people haven't quite noticed?
I think what that is how Congress acted in relation to the sanction legislation that it passed a few weeks ago. Some of that legislation was directed against Iran and North Korea, but the really important part was directed against Russia and, in principle, against European companies dealing with Russia. Obviously, the way in which this whole issue has been framed in a lot of the media discussion has been around Trump and the question about Russian interference in the American election and the Trump campaign's possible collusion with that. So the whole frame in which this has been looked at is via this is a way of constraining Trump, and in some sense Trump and Russia had this coming to them for what they jointly supposedly did. But I think that there's a much sort of more important, in some sense, certainly for the long-term story, is what's going on here. And this is essentially that Congress, near unanimously, because there were only two votes against in the Senate and three in the House of Representatives, has effectively decided to change something quite fundamental about American foreign policy and to make it very difficult for the president to do anything about that. And certainly in the last 50, 60 years, probably longer than that, certainly since the Second World War anyway, is the president has been the dominant political actor in American foreign policy. But what we've seen here is essentially that Congress has said that it wants to change the context of Russia sanctions in a way that is hugely consequential for the European Union, particularly for the northwestern member states of the European Union. In fact, you could say for all of them in different ways. And that it wants to draw a line under the way in which the sanctions with Russia have been dealt with since the Obama presidency. The first sanctions against Russia were put in place in 2014 in response to what happened in Ukraine. And what was striking about those sanctions was that didn't in many respects hurt Russia very deeply, and in particular they didn't hurt in any deep sense Russia's energy interests, and they certainly didn't do anything to disrupt the capacity of European Union states to trade with Russia in relation to energy, and in particular in relation to gas. Now what you've got on the European Union side is profound divisions that have been going on for the last 2 years about essentially the agreement between the Russian gas company Gazprom and various five European companies, I think they are, to build a new pipeline called Nord Stream 2 that would basically take more gas direct from Russia to northwest European countries and bypass the pipelines that go through Ukraine.
So there's a huge amount in that. Let's just unpack it a bit. So I've got a whole series of questions or thoughts about this. So one is, one of the dominant themes of American politics in recent years is that it's almost impossible for Congress to pass legislation because so bipartisan, so the opposite of bipartisan, everything is toxic and divisive. And certainly on almost all domestic matters, that seems to be the case. I mean, Obama spent 6 years having to find a route round Congress because nothing could go through it. So here we have near unanimity on a foreign policy question. So before we get onto the question of the EU and what this might do to American-European relations, what's going on there? Why is it that Congress can't legislate on domestic matters but can come to an almost unanimous agreement on a really consequential but also quite controversial issue in foreign policy?
I think that is absolutely the question, and it's a question I've been thinking about for the last few weeks. I don't actually really know what the answer to it is, I'm afraid. It just is an overwhelming difference between what has happened in domestic matters. I mean, I think you could reasonably say that essentially Congress hasn't been able to legislate in domestic matters since 2010, since essentially the Democrats lost their filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And here you have Congress acting, as you say, near unanimously. And the only thing I think that one can say about this is that it is in some sense, though I don't think this is the entire explanation, reflective of just how deep in the political establishment the opposition to Trump is. So what this legislation does, leaving aside the geopolitics of it, is it effectively stops the president acting in foreign policy terms on what you might say is, if not the most important, one of the most important matters in foreign policy of our time.
So could it then be a harbinger of things to come, in the sense that if you get the right question, the fact that almost the entire American political establishment is against Trump, that does find its voice. As things stand at the moment, that has to be a foreign policy question. But presumably, as we go down the line, these people will feel empowered by this. Other issues will allow that to happen.
I think so. I mean, I think that if you looked at it purely from Trump's point of view, it's a total disaster. It effectively, in some sense, ends his presidency. Now, some people might think that that's a good thing.
And you saying that, given the coverage we've had this week, I mean, you're the only person I've heard, maybe I don't read the right things, you're the only person I've heard say that that's the biggest disaster for Trump over the past few weeks.
I think it is. I don't want to get into the
Now, let's not talk about the other disasters. Let's focus on this one.
Effectively, what that showed was that he would not be able to do anything in relation to Russia for the entirety of his presidency, so long as it lasts. And it shows how completely deep and comprehensive the opposition to him within the legislature was. Because that's an astonishing thing for a legislature to do, unless, I think, that they're saying, actually, we don't recognise the legitimacy of this presidency.
It's fascinating. I think I'm a bit sceptical about how this could extend to other issues. I mean, I think the reasoning seems to be that if Trump is perceived as being too soft on Russia, in cahoots with Russia in many sort of troubling ways, then taking a harder line on Russian sanctions does have a unifying impact on Congress as an expression of its criticism of the president. That seems to me, as explanations go, pretty compelling. But as a basis for a general opposition to the presidency, I mean, it would have to be worked out issue by issue. I mean, there must be loads of other issues where people in Congress wouldn't see eye to eye in the same way. And I think foreign policy is much more susceptible to being a basis for some kind of common position across the political spectrum than domestic matters. Yeah, it always has been.
And you could say this is kind of the mirror of the classic story that's told about presidents, which is when they can't legislate, they do stuff in foreign affairs because it's the only place they can find an outlet. And you could say after however many years of not being able to get anything done in Congress, they found an outlet for something that allows them to feel empowered.
I can see that, but I think that if you look at the substance, though, of what's in this bill, and you look at the situation in regard to US relations with Russia, even a year ago, this was very much contested political territory.
So Trump is the person who has unified Congress against him.
The Obama administration absolutely was not willing to take action on the issue of the Nord Stream pipeline. It was opposed to the Nord Stream pipeline, but it was not prepared to do anything about it. And at the same time, this time last year, Obama and John Kerry were still working on trying to achieve a ceasefire in Syria with Russia, and were, at least in July of last year, were still talking about joint military action between US and the Russian military. I mean, we're so far away from that now. There you had a Democratic president who was down one path where Russia was concerned. You had people like John McCain, I'm just using as an example, who were extremely unhappy about that and were complaining bitterly about what that represented in terms of US-Russia relations. So this was contested political space. Now it's not contested at all.
I mean, there's so much in this, but the other big aspect of it is what it means for Europe, as you said, because the meaty part of this legislation constrains European companies in their dealings with Russia. So one of the many ironies here is potentially that means for some Europeans, Trump is their friend. I mean, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And if Congress is trying to stop European countries and companies doing the energy deals they want to do with Russia, then is it possible that those companies and countries are going to have to look to Trump to forge some kind of alliance to allow them to get out from under this
I think legislation? That is quite possible. And what is...
Because that does my head in.
It is quite notable is that the adjustments that were made to the legislation as it was going through both houses of Congress ultimately meant that the president does still have discretion about applying sanctions against European companies, so against the extraterritorial sanctions part of this.
So Germans have to go to Trump and say, please, Mr. President, allow us to do our gas dealings with the Russians.
Effectively, yes.
Wow.
What's the position of the Secretary of State on this? Because is he not also in some way being targeted?
Quite possibly. It's not clear. And the things that Tillerson himself said about the sanctions were quite ambiguous. I can't believe that he doesn't have some problems with them. I mean, the other thing, which I haven't said yet about it, is that there clearly is an American commercial interest at stake here. And this is the argument that the Germans and the Austrians, who at government levels have been the ones within the EU, have been most vociferous on the subject, keep stressing. And that is that it isn't simply that the US Congress is saying we don't want European companies to engage commercially with Russia about gas. They're saying, the Germans and the Austrians allege, and I think not unreasonably, is we want the European Union states to be buying liquid natural gas from the United States and not buying pipeline gas from Russia. On top of the questions about the geopolitics of it, there's a straightforward conflict of economic interests. And here is where the Trump position is complicated again, because Trump himself has actually been quite a strong advocate of the US selling more natural gas to European countries. I mean, made it quite a big part of the speech that he gave was when he was in Poland. Poland take an entirely different view of this matter than the Germans and the Austrians, I should say. They don't want to buy gas from Russia, and they do want to buy it from the United States. So there's plenty of room for the Americans to play the European countries off against each other as well.
So I'm going to ask one last question about this, which is kind of the blunt Trump question. So you've just described an account of what's been going on in American politics, which you say is the heart of it, which doesn't feature much in the endless round of stories about Paul Manafort and the FBI investigation and Trump's tweeting and everything else. Do we want to say that what you've just described is the real story? Because it's quite a realpolitik story, and it does treat Trump, as well as his opponents, as sort of relatively rational actors, sort of know what they're doing, but with all sorts of conflicting interests and challenges ahead of them. Do you want to say that we should spend less time talking about Trump's tweeting and more time talking about this? Because I'm really unsure about this, because I still think the real story, given the kind of politician Trump is, the surface is still really important. It can't just be that there's a realpolitik story underneath the surface and that the surface is froth.
I don't think the surface is froth. I think that the surface is going to be pretty consequential.
And the surface might do for him.
In terms of what happens, yeah, the surface might well do for him. But I do think that for the future, given that the Trump presidency will end one way or another in the end, we need to be engaged more with these underlying economic and structural questions.
Well, absolutely, because a lot of things that happen now, I mean, that's the thing that no one seems to be able to get beyond, which is just thinking about it's Trump world and we live in it. But a lot of things that happen in Trump world will have consequences that go way beyond Trump.
I don't think it's either or. I think it has to be both. They're also not unrelated to one another. So in some ways, what's the relationship between the behaviour and the policies, the policy decisions? It's kind of interesting to think about. But I think Helen's absolutely right that it's possible to get distracted, I think, by the sort of the curious personality of Trump and the kind of things that he does. There are, you know, important things happening. Policy decisions, politics, continues. Congress operates in interesting ways. It still exists as a key actor And I would say it's maybe the more, that's the sort of the heart of the story. It may not be the decisive thing in the end, but it's still, I think, the kind of the heart of it. And it will be the thing that lives on, I think, in a sort of post-Trump era.
So the thing that has been not preoccupying me, but I've been thinking about on and off. I don't want it to sound like I've been obsessed about this, because I haven't. But it's just struck me more than once that there's a question that maybe we could try and answer. Relates to what's been happening in Venezuela, which is one of the big sort of global geopolitical events of recent weeks. And so we're not going to talk about that in its own terms. That would be a whole separate program. But its potential impact on British politics, because there's been quite a lot of coverage here. It's died away now, but in recent weeks, about whether Jeremy Corbyn might be damaged by this, given his support for the Chavez and then Maduro regimes. Why does it not seem to bother people? And it's clear it doesn't really bother people. I've seen articles with headlines that say things like, so what? The next British general election is not being fought in Venezuela, it's going to be fought here. You know, we've just been talking about how people have maybe missed the big story in America. Aaron on this podcast says it a lot. Foreign policy famously doesn't really register in electoral terms. But still, I would like to know more about how people think about this question. I've been interested in British politics for a long time, 20 plus years. I've been aware of Corbyn throughout that time. He was certainly a figure in British politics before he became leader of the Labour Party. If you'd asked me what Jeremy Corbyn stands for, I'd have said he's not a domestic politician. He's very much an international-minded politician. He's in that part of the Labour Party for whom international issues actually have primacy, so that's quite rare. The two big issues for him are Ireland. Before he became leader of the Labour Party, I would have said Jeremy Corbyn, in a sense, speaks for Sinn Féin within the Labour Party, and that's well known, and we now also know that people don't mind about that. But the other thing is that he is a supporter of Chavez. I mean, that was the thing that I knew about him. It seems to me it's sort of central to who he is politically. And the Chavez project is in tatters. I don't think there's any argument about that. So why doesn't it matter? And I think that in the analysis I've read of it, people don't try and sort of unpick what's going on here. Because it seems to me there are two kinds of things that people are wanting to say on the conservative part of British politics to attack him, but they don't disentangle them. So one of them is that why isn't he condemning bad people? But that has very little legs because all politicians are in that boat. I mean, it's not as if the Tories are whiter than white on these questions either. It's not like there's something special about Corbyn. There are certain regimes that he seems to be more tolerant of than others. He can turn it back on his opponents. The other question is, are people trying to suggest that what happened in Venezuela might happen here if Corbyn became prime minister? Which seems like a stretch. But the other possibility, and then this is, I'll ask you what you think, is that there is something in between the two. So this is the bit where I wonder whether there may still be something in this, which is not just why isn't he condemning them? And after all, he said about Venezuela what Trump has been saying about white supremacism, which is he blamed violence on all sides. But with Corbyn, that's fine in a sense, because that's what he usually says. It's not, I don't think people read into it what they read into Trump's statements. And also, Corbyn is consistent on this. But what the Chavez experiment and its subsequent failure does seem to suggest is that there is a political mindset which reacts badly to the failure of the ideological project. And I just wonder whether there isn't still a possibility at the back of some people's minds that the thing that gives them doubt about Corbyn is not what he believes in, because a lot of people quite like what he believes in, and it's not his personality, because he seems quite a refreshing person, but it's the thought of, great, he's a conviction politician, he's unspun, he comes across as different from the rest. But what would happen if you gave him and people like him power, and then the things that they wanted to happen were blocked? Now, he wouldn't behave like the Venezuelan regime would behave, because our institutional arrangements would make that impossible. But is there any possibility that there is still going to be lingering in the back of people's minds the next time they make a choice about who they want to be prime minister, a thought, not he should have been more critical of these people, or a Corbyn premiership will end up with Venezuelan-style riots, but this guy is not going to react well to the failure of his project, and all political projects fail. That's the thing that has been nagging away at me.
If you'd asked me this question before the general election here, I think I would have agreed with you, in the sense that I thought...
So agreed about the possibility of there still being a nagging doubt about what a politician like Corbyn does with power.
Yeah. I thought that that distrust of ideological projects and some sort of historical understanding, not in a particularly, you know, developed sense, but some sort of understanding of what the history of ideological projects have been and how they pretty much repeat the same pattern, was, a political fact in collective British politics.
And sort of collective memory in a sense.
Yeah, I must admit, one of the things that I've had to think about pretty hard since the election is that I think that I was wrong about that. And that I'm not entirely sure that it, in fact, I'm not at all sure that it is any longer. And that maybe that sense has resonance with people like you and me, and but that I'm not sure how wide or deep it goes amongst the British electorate, particularly amongst people younger than us.
And is it, in a sense, to put it in those terms, because there is a generational gap in that politics for us still has a lingering ideological quality, and it is almost post-ideological for people whose entire political experience is basically post-Cold War. Is that part of it?
I think that we grew up in ways that perhaps you didn't really understand at the time, in the shadow of ideological failures. You know, they came from the left and they came from the right, Nazism and Soviet communism. And it was pretty clear that there was, you know, a terrible price that was paid for those regimes. And I think it did generate a view that, in some sense, particularly in intense forms, that ideology was not to be trusted politically. But the world is different and people have grown up not under that shadow. And times are, you know, extremely difficult for many people. And so the desire to believe that that situation can be radically different, and somebody telling an ideological story about how that might come about, I'm not sure that saying, you know, it doesn't usually turn out very well when you go down this road really works as an argument.
And of course, there are many other things to say, one of which is that the Labour Manifesto, we've talked about this before, was not a particularly ideological document. I mean, it's not as if Corbyn stood on the ideological Chavist platform when he ran against Theresa May. He stood on a Labour catch-all platform.
I think there's another possible explanation. I agree that the Venezuela accusation doesn't really stick, because if it's translated into it's going to happen here, then it just seems farcical. But one of the other possible explanations is that there has been an appeal to the left of projects such as Chavismo in Venezuela, because of some sense of trying to look around the world and see where some social change is taking place and to jump on it as a possible inspiration for a disenchanted left.
Particularly post 1989. I mean, that's right. Absolutely where the search around the world began.
And there weren't that many options. And so somebody like Chavez emerges and you think, great, here's an example where you can say it's all happening in Latin America. And so Chavez had this seductive appeal for a left that had lost its sense of purpose in Britain and in some parts of Europe. Now, if you are a left-wing party who's beginning to think that actually they can take hold of power, have a decent chance electorally of winning, and begin to think seriously about their domestic project, you become just less interested in this. It's less of a factor. And so I think the reason why it didn't stick so much this time round is that you're actually dealing with somebody like Corbyn, who in the past has been associated with that, but in some sense has kind of bigger fish to fry, which is running a party that actually could possibly plausibly win elections. So I think had it happened before, the stakes would have been less high, because this would have been sort of somebody in the opposition, but it would have been much more damaging. I mean, there are other examples. The Spanish left-wing party Podemos has been massively damaged, I think, by its relationship to Venezuela.
And has been much more critical in recent weeks, am I right, of what's been going on there?
Well, I think because it's more of a problem, because some of those people were actually ideologically emerged out of Chavismo and then came to Spain. It was that way around. So that's interesting. But I just think it's because that moment has maybe passed, even for Corbyn.
So two other things I want to say about this, which is that, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is, I think it's clear now, Jeremy Corbyn is a very lucky politician. We didn't realise that, but now we can see it. In this context, I think one of the things he has going for him is Ken Livingstone. I think Ken Livingstone has been very useful for the Corbyn project, because he is a kind of lightning rod. I mean, Ken Livingstone says the things that Corbyn can't say and maybe wouldn't say. So in this case, it was Livingstone who said, the context matters here. You know, I've looked at the context. It doesn't quite sound as bad as it might when you hear it in context. But he said essentially that the reason Venezuela is in the state it is now is because Chavez did not kill the oligarchs when he first came to power. And so Venezuela is still in the grip of a kind of oligarchical and propped up by US capital oligarchical regime pulling the strings. The only way the Chavez project could have worked would have been to get rid of those people. He subsequently said he wasn't advocating killing anyone, blah, blah, blah. But nonetheless, you know, were Corbyn to have said that, I think that would have been very damaging. But Livingston says it. So first of all, it's a lightning rod. But secondly, Livingston says that. He says things about Hitler. He says things about the Jews, da, da, da. But people remember that Ken Livingston was mayor of London, and London didn't become Caracas. You know, Ken Livingston was in his way, rather ineffectual, perfectly amiable mayor of London. Not particularly ideological, did a few good things. So were a Corbyn premiership to be like a Livingston mayoralty? I think people are sort of, yeah, whatever. It's not, so there's a kind of words and deeds mismatch. Helen, you're looking a bit skeptical.
I think that's partly true, but I also remember that the first time that Livingston was faced with Johnson, Boris Johnson, and lost that election to be mayor of London. I think the Venezuela issue actually did matter a bit and didn't help Livingston, because Livingston was involved in various foreign policy projects for London, and one of which was about some oil deal that he was striking with Chavez. But I do recall that there was a critique that really developed in that campaign about basically Livingston was interested in being, you know, like mayor of Caracas and wasn't interested in being mayor of London, and that he was seeing the role in foreign policy terms, if you like. And at the time, the defeat of Livingston by Johnson was taken as a kind of prelude to the Conservatives becoming the largest party in the 2010 general election. But I think we can see now, looking back, that it's actually astonishing that Boris Johnson beat the Labour candidate twice to be mayor of London, when we look at how fundamentally Labour London is as a city.
But I still think
that in those circumstances in which Livingston could lose as badly as he did, and that that argument was played against him, that it had some potency.
But I still think that for Corbyn, it's not necessarily bad news. First of all, Corbyn has to be prime minister before then it can be thrown back against him.
Absolutely.
That he's a foreign policy prime minister. And secondly, Ken Livingston is still around to take some of the heat.
Yeah.
And then the other stroke of luck Corbyn has is, of course, Trump, because a lot of what motivates this on the left is anti-American capitalist imperialism. That's when you don't have to scratch very hard, and what comes out is this sense that American capital is driving the failure of the Chavez revolution. Well, with Trump as president, anti-Americanism isn't a problem, I think, in British politics. Certainly not for now. If nothing else, doesn't matter one way or the other, but it takes a huge amount of the heat out of it, which I think is certainly true, that a lot of Corbyn's foreign policy positions are driven by wanting to oppose what he sees as American imperial interests. And even though, as Helen will remind us, Trump is not that kind of American imperialist, but the mere fact that one of the things that Trump has said in recent weeks is that maybe we need to start looking at armed intervention in Venezuela, that's fine by Corbyn for Trump to be saying that. Okay, I've got that off my chest.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is Talking Politics. My name is David Runciman. Chris, so you've been in France. I'll let people know at the end we're going to put out a special edition, an additional podcast this week to talk about Macron in broader historical perspective. But what's your sense, and I think this is something you've been thinking about, what's your sense of where we are? You know, you're kind of our person to tell us about how French politics is unfolding. Where we are in the Macron presidency, it's been a sort of roller coaster in many ways already. We're about 100 days in.
Yep, I think it's 102 days.
And that 100-day thing is now, it's an Americanism, but it's become a French milestone too.
slightly reluctantly, if you can.
As with all Americanisms.
Yeah, but it's become a bit of a theme. I mean, you know, you can't really look back after 2 weeks or after a month. After 3 months, it starts to become a little bit more plausible. Politics happens so quickly, this actually seemed like a bit of time now.
Even though part of that is French holiday. I mean, so I say British politics goes on holiday. French politics does go on holiday still, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It is on holiday currently. The last meeting of the government was, I think, on the 8th of August. Then things basically shut down. The 28th of August, I think, is when the government meets again officially. And so that's what they call la rentrée politique. But the pause is also an opportunity for reflection. So people are starting to think. I think some of the discussion's been pretty interesting. I mean, the French have got these two terms, again, English terms, they call Macronmania, Macronmania. And they now have the Macron bashing. These are just common currency. And there's something a bit sort of schizophrenic, you know, going from one to the other. But the figures do speak for themselves. I mean, Macron was elected on, very, very successfully, defeated Marine Le Pen. Sort of a wave of optimism about what Macron could achieve in France.
Low turnout, we have to remember, relatively.
Well, if we go back and look in detail, we can then unpick. But there was a certain sense, in France as well as outside France, that this was a decisive moment and young, sort of handsome, etc. So there was this great wave of optimism. And it was felt in France as well as outside of France. Now, things have changed. I mean, his approval ratings for the month of August are down to the low 30s.
Which is lower than Trump, it should be said, for what that's worth, which isn't much.
But. That's right. So that's why people are beginning to sort of take note and think, what's going on? You know, has something changed? Has something sort of soured? And it's just interesting to try and unpick that. And I think there are some things that have struck me. One is, it's obvious, he was elected, with quite a high sort of number of people voting for him. But many of those voting for him were voting against his opponent. It was a lesser evil sort of argument. It wasn't really a massive endorsement of Macron. He basically has a kind of core of, I think, 24-25%. These are the people who voted for him in the first round, really seduced by the Macron project, some of whom were absorbed by his En Marche movement and have continued as people involved in his, in his party. But that's basically slightly less than 1 in 4 of French voters. So you then have a massive number of people who are not that convinced, quite hostile to him in fact, but were willing to either vote for him or to abstain. So it's not really surprising that you have quite a steep decline reasonably soon after he comes to power.
But does that happen each time with the French presidential election, given the way that it's set up? So the core vote comes out in the first round, and then in the second round, it's the lesser of the two evils vote, so Chirac and others. Do they see an equivalent fall-off in approval rating over the early period?
Well, no. This has been quite quick. Where you have seen a sort of a distinctive change, a sort of a souring of public opinion, there's usually been a pretty obvious explanation. So the one that springs to mind, there are lots of examples, but when Nicolas Sarkozy won the presidency, he went on an incredibly ill-judged holiday on a splendid yacht.
The bling holiday.
Yes, so this was the bling holiday. Everyone hated that. He never really recovered in some ways. Now, Macron hasn't done anything like that. His holidays were secret for a while. We now know that he's in Marseille. Marseille is a sort of a very kind of, as the French call it, a kind of a proletarian city. It's kind of a working class city. He's not in a particularly sort of luxurious place. I mean, it's not an ill-judged move. So there doesn't seem to be some explanation for why things have turned on him, apart from the fact that it just reveals the reasonably circumscribed nature of his support.
But to go back to where we started with Helen and American foreign policy, it is clear from the outside. He had a very good first sort of 6 weeks, but it was very much focused on him projecting internationally. He had the meeting with Trump, which people in Britain were surprised there was less fuss about it in France than there would be if Theresa May had brought Trump over here. But there was a lot of focus on France's place in the world. And if it is true that that's actually not what people care about compared to domestic economic bread and butter issues, was that a mistake?
Well, no, so people care about it a bit, and I think the French care about it
more than some.
Perhaps more than some. And this question of its status in the world, this is an issue. Now, Macron saw very quickly that he could capitalise on anti-Trump feeling and this sense of America's place in the world really being questioned, and there was some sort of room for him to manoeuvre and fears about the populist tide. I mean, he was very clever in seeing this was an opportunity, not in domestic politics, this was a foreign policy opportunity to actually have some sort of place for France in some of these big international meetings. He did that very successfully. I think it's probably the thing in his sort of first, you know, few months in power that people are reasonably satisfied with, but it doesn't run that deep. And the things that I think people probably are most sort of concerned about now is really what the future holds in terms of what he's planning to do in domestic politics. And the beginnings of that are not particularly good for him. And this is where, I mean, this is extremely interesting. Macron has committed himself to a certain set of targets. One is the budget deficit targets. He knows that he's not going to be taken seriously in the rest of Europe, and especially by the Germans, if he doesn't reach this 3%. Those are the rules. France has to respect those rules if it wants to be taken seriously. Now, he's made it very clear that's what he wants to do, and he's made some pretty unpopular decisions, some of which there's been quite a lot of kickback in France, especially from the military, about cuts that he's then had to exercise his authority on. So he's very committed to that. But what's interesting is that he doesn't really seem to have a European vision. What he's doing is that he's saying to, I think, people in France, if we want to be a big players in Europe, if we want to lead Europe, we have to get our own ship in order. And that basically means getting our budget deficit under control and reforming the labour code, as they call it in France, labour laws. And those are very unpopular things that he's trying to push through with this sort of carrot of some dramatic European deal that he can do with Merkel, if that can be done at home.
I agree, and I think that you can see that certain measures that he's done, I think there's one in particular in relation to housing, the French equivalent of housing benefit, that hasn't gone down
for young people
well at all.
Cut housing benefit for young people.
Clearly the row with the military and the general resigning hurt him. I mean, I also wonder, I mean, just from the outside, whether that whole thing that he did at Versailles, effectively summoning the parliament to him, and then the rhetoric that came out around it, effectively him comparing himself to the god Jupiter. I find it hard to think that there weren't a reasonable number of people in France who thought, what on earth is this about? And I think that one of the things that he has a problem with is that he became a symbol, not just actually for some people in France, but way beyond it, as if, you know, Macron was a symbol that supposedly populism had been defeated and put back in its box. So all kinds of, in many ways, ludicrous expectations of what Macron can possibly do were put onto him. And you would have to say that he kind of encouraged it. And I think that I was going to call it a stunt, but let's call it a performance at Versailles, kind of played into that and created pretty early on a sort of sense of hubris around him.
So let me ask two final things that relate to what we were talking about earlier with Corbyn. So there is this sort of l'état c'est moi angle to Macron, and while he's still fresh and young and the project is just beginning, people may have their doubts, but it's got sort of projection and it carries a certain conviction to it. Do you think there is, you know, coming back to my point earlier, that nagging thought at the back of people's mind, what would that kind of politics be like when he doesn't meet his targets? What would that kind of politics be like when the En Marche movement becomes really fractious? And you know, it's sunny, the weather is fine for Macron, and so he's pretending to be Louis XIV, and yeah, we'll see where that goes. But that sort of personal power politics and the failure of the project makes me feel a bit anxious. And I'm not French, as you may have guessed.
Macron, it's interesting, he did encourage this. He did, I think. But there's also some basic realities on the ground. I mean, Macron's victory exposed the entirely moribund nature of some massive existing political organisations. I mean, the socialists now, they have a tenth of the parliamentary sort of deputies that they had before. They're down to, I think it's 31 or 34. And Macron cleaned up in the legislative elections much, you know, people didn't expect him to. So he's been faced with a situation where, objectively speaking, he is just much more powerful than he expected. And it's not because, I mean, he was involved in that and he was partly responsible for that and he has sort of egged that on a bit, but it's also that he just, I think, did a service to France in revealing how empty some of its political organisations were. So he has to then deal with that. And in some ways, it's a poison chalice for him, I think. I'm not sure. I think people feel uncomfortable, I think, about this slightly top-down nature in which his political project is developing. Some people who were supporters of Macron in France and outside of France have begun to sort of talk about this, the emperor sort of metaphor. So that's, people are concerned with that. But I think it's going to take a while for it to work itself out, but one of the main concerns is the way his organization is run. So the way En Marche as a movement is transforming into a party, how does it actually work? What does it actually look like? And there are some people who are part of this movement as representatives in the assembly who feel like they're just being bossed around. And on top of it, they're new to this, so they're just learning the ropes, and they're also being, you know, disciplined very much and told how to do things, and they don't like it. But that reflects, I think, the way that he runs this whole movement. It was always really him, and it remains him.
So finally, the established parties are moribund. It does seem really well set up for the French Corbyn, which is sort of what he is, though he's outside of the main party of the left, Mélenchon, to kind of make hay, right? He's got a young, charismatic president who was elected on a wave of high hopes, who's already starting to look like he may have feet of clay, but who represents things, many of which are very unpopular. So, like, he's personally popular and he embodies hope, but as you say, in real practical terms, many things he wants to do are not wanted by most of the French people at all. He can also be tied to an earlier regime, which is profoundly unpopular. And then we've seen from Corbyn that the kinds of politics that Mélenchon stands for maybe are very popular. I mean, is that where the central battle is going to be? Is French politics for the next, say, year, 18 months, going to be Macron versus Mélenchon?
So Mélenchon has been having a good run since the presidential elections, it's true.
And we should add, by the way, Mélenchon also was untouched by the Venezuela, more or less, accusations in the French presidential election. A lot was made of it. He's brushed it off.
He's been doing well, I think, partly because, I mean, the number of deputies in the assembly is not very large, but they are pretty skilled operators. You know, all these people who are members of La France Insoumise have been in politics for a long time, even though they might not have been sort of, you know, members of parliament ever before. They've been involved in local politics, so they very quickly got a handle on how things work. In contrast to those in En Marche, many of whom had no experience of politics at all, have found it more difficult. So they've created this core of skilled operators who are really using the parliamentary game to get their message across. And Mélenchon has put himself forward as the main opposition. Now, that may succeed, but the question is whether the Socialist Party is able to pick itself up again. If it can't, and there was open talk about it simply disappearing. You know, they're talking about selling the iconic headquarters on the Rue Solferino because it's in too much of a plush area, and also to plug a financial gap. I mean, there are big things happening which may suggest it's going to simply disappear. If that's the case, then I think, yes, Mélenchon does become quite a plausible figure to challenge Macron. You know, but the Socialist Party may manage to come back and get together again and start to position itself, in which case you start to have a more divided left and Mélenchon gets challenged a bit more. But people are beginning to say, if Macron fails, then we all know what's going to happen. It's Mélenchon versus Le Pen. And people were saying that even before the presidential election.
Or Mélenchon versus Le Pen equivalent, because who knows where she'll be in
five years' time. She's been a bit quieter. People say that she's getting ready to come back after the end of the summer.
But as it were, a version of Mélenchon versus a version of Le Pen. And the defeat of populism will look like anything but. So as I mentioned earlier on, we're going to put out a special extra edition of Talking Politics this week, which is a conversation we recorded between two of the leading British historians of France, Robert Toombs, who's appeared regularly on this podcast and tends to call things correctly, and John Keegar, who lives in France, as well as being a historian of the French state and French foreign policy. And they're going to take a slightly more historical view of where Macron fits in to the evolution, not just of French politics, but of Anglo-French relations, including why people in France think that Brexit is Dunkirk all over again. So if you subscribe, you'll get that episode automatically. If you don't, do please download it from wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back next week, and we will be back full time with you from the start of September with a new partner, all sorts of exciting new guests, and we will be with you every week. Do please join us for that. My name is David Runciman, and we've been Talking Politics. Okay. I need to remember how we do this. Right. Hello, my name is David Runciman, and this is Talking Politics. And we're with you in real time this week. It is Wednesday, the 16. Let's do that again.
I went to Snowdonia in the first earlier part of July.
Wasn't that where Theresa May
did her walking
holiday, where she decided to call the election? Did you have any moments where you thought, this is how politics works?
No, I didn't.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.